I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The Gaming Control Board is hosting a public meeting tomorrow at the Convention Center to announce who will be awarded Philadelphia's second casino. There are four contenders with sites at 400 North Broad Street, 8th and Market Streets, Front and Pattison, and 900 Packer near the sports stadiums. This decision has been in the works for almost 2 years. We asked Chris Brennan to join us once again. He's political editor for the Philadelphia Daily News and has been a guest on the show in the past talking about casinos in Philadelphia. Chris, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Always fun to be here.
Is there any mystery that the control board will make their decision, whatever it is, tomorrow?
The control board is a strange organization in that they have an agenda and they're going to discuss the license tomorrow. It's widely anticipated that they will grant the license to one of the four applicants, but you never really know until they vote.
Well, and what I read probably from reading you and some of the other local papers is that Live Hotel and Casino, this is the one down at 900 Packer, that they're going to get the nod?
That is the word. That's sort of a it almost feels like a soft reveal on the part of the Gaming Control Board and the people behind the Live Casino. It's the Cordish company, the developers from Maryland who did the Inner Harbor at Baltimore, and they're teaming up with the Parks Casino people from Bensalem.
And how competitive has this been? I mean, first there were six, now there are four, and it looks like there will be one tomorrow.
Yeah, it has been a competitive process with people that have experience in this. But two of the applicants who withdrew were Penn National Gaming, which already runs a casino in Pennsylvania, and Steve Wynn, who's one of the biggest casino developers in the world. But they left. They left the game. And so the Xfinity Live people, the Cordish people have experience. Everybody has like a gaming operator who has some sort of experience in the casino business.
Let me give out that phone number to our listeners. It's 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We're covering three news items during this hour of the show, beginning with the fact that the Gaming Control Board is going to announce tomorrow at the Convention Center who will be awarded Philadelphia's second casino, and we would like to hear from you. Chris, I was reading about a pretty raucous meeting that was in South Philadelphia at Stella Maris Parish House down in South Philadelphia. I think it was last week. I guess the idea, anticipating that there might be a casino at 900 Packer Street, what was going on there?
Well, that was organized by Barbara Capozzi. She ran for city council in 2011, came very close to winning the second district seat. She is also very active in the stadium district down there and has played a role in sort of negotiating for the community as they built the stadiums, which they were not crazy about.
Right.
And so that's sort of an 11th hour sort of reaction to the rumor that 9th and Packer is going to be the license. I mean, these applications have been public records for 2 years, and there's been some community input, but nothing like we saw the first time around when the first applications went in 2005 and were granted in December of 2006.
Which raises questions about, I mean, there was this organization. They were, I guess, on Radio Times a number of times, Casino Free Philadelphia. Obviously, it's not casino free. There's one and a second one coming. Has the opposition just kind of melted away from your perspective?
I think Casino Free Philadelphia is still there, and they do attend Gaming Control Board hearings when they're in Philadelphia talking about the local licenses. But it's not. It doesn't feel as organized or as passionate as it did in the last round.
Do you think it's a kind of David and Goliath situation, as you say, up against these pretty powerful casino organizations?
Yeah, there are different levels of groups here. Casino Free Philadelphia is a no gaming anywhere, anytime kind of group. Then there are neighborhood groups that don't really care if you put one on the Delaware River, but they just don't want it, you know, around the corner from their house. So there are people who oppose it altogether, and there are people who oppose it in their backyard.
Well, and I was reading somewhere that Mayor Nutter was interested in a more center city location, whether it was at 8th and Market or 400 North Broad, where he used to work at the old Enquirer building.
That's right. The city testified Senate officials to a Gaming Control Board hearing where they didn't officially endorse any applicant, and this is back when there were six, but they made pretty clear that they preferred either Broad and Callow Hill or 8th and Market.
It's also interesting and maybe not surprising that Sugar House, the lone casino in Philadelphia, not really excited about a second casino coming to the city.
Appealing the ruling right now from the Commonwealth Court.
Is that right?
Yeah. Sugar House is suing. And from a legal strategy, even a delay, a legal delay, a long, drawn-out appellate process could be a win for Sugar House, even if they ultimately lose that case, which they may, because any month – that goes by without competition in the city is more money for Sugar House. It's more money for Harrah's down in Chester. There's a financial incentive to delay.
That's not an argument you could make before a court or not. But do you know what their argument is about preventing a second casino?
Essentially, their argument is that the law passed in 2004 to allow casinos in the state says nothing about reissuing a license if it's been revoked. So it talks about how to issue a license but not how to reissue a license.
And there's a little history here in that Foxwoods wanted to set up a casino in Philadelphia. That license got yanked by the control board.
That's right. Foxwoods was granted a license in December of 2006. They were originally going to build on Columbus Boulevard at Reed Street. They ran into a lot of community and city opposition. And then with Mayor Nutter, they attempted to reboot their project at 8th and Market in the old Strawbridge and Clothier building. And that didn't work out. The delays continued there. There was significant opposition from the neighborhood around. And then the Casino Control Board told them to go back to South Philadelphia. And it was just a cascading problems, funding. So eventually in December 2010, after 4 years, the Game Control Board had had enough and revoked it.
You know, it's interesting to be having this conversation about a second casino in Philadelphia when the Taj Mahal in Atlantic City just announced that it would be closing in December. I think that's the fifth Atlantic City casino to close this year. I mean, part of the reason is that they are losing business to Pennsylvania casinos, and I'm assuming Philadelphia as well. But it's an interesting time to be thinking about how many casinos for what benefit.
Yeah, I think that that's one of the claims that the opposition will use, that either there should be no second casino in Philadelphia or there should be no casino close to I-95. And they're using the failures in Atlantic City. But at the same time, New York is going through the licensing process. New York is getting ready to grant casino licenses. So as the market shrinks in one place, it grows in another.
Is there any way to know? I know the casinos are making money and the state and I guess the city gets some money off of that. Has it been good for Pennsylvania, do you know? And then we'll get to a caller here.
Well, I mean, the idea was that this was supposed to reduce property taxes for Pennsylvanians and the wage tax here in Philadelphia. And, I don't know anybody who thinks their property taxes are too low or that the wage tax is too low. It'd certainly be good for casino operators.
They're making a lot of money.
Yeah. I don't think they'd do it if there wasn't serious money behind it.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Chris Brennan, political editor for the Philadelphia Daily News, getting our conversation started. A news announcement tomorrow, the Gaming Control Board meeting in the Convention Center in Philadelphia to announce who will be the city's second casino. And I have to say, when we did casino shows years ago, the phones would explode and everyone would go crazy, kind of quiet in this announcement. You can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Dave from Yardley to join us. Dave, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi. Thanks.
Hi there.
I'm currently driving 95. I've done this for probably 10 years. And if there's any major event at any of the stadiums, it's impossible to either get through that area or even to get off of that area. The ramps are the original ramps, as far as I know, for getting off at Broad Street and those areas. And yet it's never been improved with all of the building that's gone on in that area. So now if they're going to add something else to the mix, I certainly hope that somebody will draw attention to those access in and out to get to those events so it doesn't get even worse than it is now.
Well, Dave, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Chris, anyone who has driven on 95 when there's a game or two there can attest to what Dave is talking about.
Sure. Traffic is always an issue in a casino application. The casinos always come up with a traffic plan, and the neighbors always talk about or the people who drive in that area always talk about the existing conditions. I don't know anybody who thinks 8th and Market has great traffic conditions, and, you know, Broad and Callahill has its challenges as well. There's a certain irony here in that the crowds that cause that traffic are the reason why the casino at 9th and Packer wants to build a casino.
Because there are people there, right?
They've got some infrastructure. They've got before games and after games. There are other things that will draw people there that can be captured in that casino audience. So traffic is always an issue. One of the curiosities of this was that one of the strengths of Steve Wynn's plan for up in Fishtown on the Delaware riverbanks was that I-95 had just completed some brand new ramps up there that had been planned for a long time, and they would have dumped right onto the front lawn of what would have been the Wynn Philadelphia, but there will be no Wynn Philadelphia.
You reminded me this has been about 10 years, right, when the Casino Act was passed in Pennsylvania.
That's right.
And I remember early on it was designed to save racetracks.
Yes.
That was the sort of original intention. And it was only going to be slots. And now, of course, we're seeing standalone casinos without racetracks, and we are seeing table games as well.
Yeah, slots are the gateway drug for gambling. It was inevitable that the money from slots would show the General Assembly in Harrisburg that there could be more money to be had if table games were added and poker rooms and things like that. So it was once the law passed in 2004, it was probably inevitable that the table games would eventually be added, and they were.
This is a meeting that's going to be held tomorrow, the Gaming Control Board. It's at the Convention Center. It's open to the public, right? So people can come and attend. What generally happens at a meeting like that?
Well, I think we may see shades of that South Philadelphia community meeting there. I think there are going to be a fair number of people who at the last minute decide they have a lot to say about casinos. And, you know, the board, sometimes they're receptive to that kind of input and sometimes they're not. And it's been a long time for them. I mean, this board has a unique voting structure in that there are four members from each of the caucuses in the General Assembly and then three appointees by the governor. And in order to grant a license, they have to have all four caucus members vote with at least one of the governor's appointees in a supermajority. And it's widely believed that the reason for the delay was they were having trouble reaching a supermajority. And if they've now reached a supermajority, I imagine they're eager to make that vote and put this whole thing in the rearview mirror.
Well, Chris Brennan, thanks for joining us on Radio Times, getting our conversation started. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And Chris Brennan is a political editor for the Philadelphia Daily News. We have a second guest waiting in the wings. We'll be talking about President Obama and immigration. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. President Obama has threatened to use his executive authority to make changes to the immigration system if Congress doesn't move ahead with reform. Republicans are fighting back. Incoming Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said what the president was doing was like waving a red flag in front of a bull. House Speaker John Boehner said Obama would burn himself if he made such a move. Joining us now is Brian Bennett. He's staff writer for the LA Times. He covers immigration and homeland security, joins us from the paper's D.C. Bureau. And Brian Bennett, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be on the show.
Is there any question about whether or not the president is going to use his authority to change our immigration laws?
Well, it seems like he is. He's promised publicly that he would take executive action on immigration before the end of the year. And what we're hearing from people inside the administration is that the president is being presented with options this week, kind of a menu of different things that he could do. And the earliest we would expect a decision announcement could be the end of this week, but he could also decide to delay that decision for another few weeks.
Do you know what's on that menu?
Sure. You can break up the ideas into two categories. There's small things that tweak different parts of the immigration system, and then there's idea to create a big program where people can come forward and apply for benefits. And so the small things, some of the things being considered are, one, increasing wages for immigration officers to boost morale because some of the immigration agencies have low morale. Another is to try to redefine who gets some of the technology visas to increase that pool so that more people can come in on technology visas that businesses want. And then another smaller thing would be to redefine instructions for deportation officers, telling them to focus even more of their energies on deporting people with long criminal records and not deporting people with only immigration violations on their record, for example. Now, the big thing that is in front of Obama would be to create a program that's modeled on the Deferred Action for Child Arrivals program, which he launched in 2012, which has given two-year work permits to more than 600,000 people who were brought to the country illegally as children. And those two-year work permits and a promise not to be deported is renewable every 2 years. The idea that Obama's been presented with would be to create a program like this for people, maybe people here who have children that are U.S. citizens, but they're here illegally, have them come forward, pay a fee, submit to a background check, and get that kind of promise that they wouldn't be deported. And the idea being that that would allow deportation officers to focus their energies on people who pose more of a threat to public safety.
Are you talking about, I guess, the parents of the Dreamers? I mean, parents of the kids who were then born in the United States who don't have a criminal record?
Yeah, so we have people who have been here for a long time, came here illegally, had children here who are now U.S. citizens, they'd be invited to come forward and apply for this deferred action status. And another idea would be to open it up for the parents of the children who've already received these work permits. And when you tally up the population, the possible population that could be eligible for these programs, it could be up to 5 million people who are eligible. Probably many fewer would actually benefit from this because some people would be kicked out because they'd be ineligible by the results of their background check or other reasons.
But it's interesting, Brian, the Obama administration has been pretty aggressive when it comes to deportation, something like, 400,000 a year? Does this really signal a shift when it comes to deportation and the president?
What the president did was he inherited a really aggressive deportation machinery that was put in place by George W. Bush. The Border Patrol was doubled from 2004 until now. And the president, when he came into office, instead of trying to dismantle that or slow it down, what he did was try to direct it. And what we've seen since the president came into office was an increase in the number of people who being deported who recently crossed the border. And actually, when you look at the number of people who are inside the United States and the interior of the United States being deported, that number has gone down slightly year on year since Obama came to office. And what the Obama administration officials say is, look, we have enough money to deport about 400,000 people a year. We're going to continue to do that. But we're going to try to focus our efforts in different ways. Now, that said, a lot of people who are caught close to the border may have deep roots, may have been here before, had deep roots here in the country, maybe even had children here. They could still be eligible for deportation, and that's still taking family members away from each other. And that's what the concerns that the community has expressed that Obama is now trying to answer.
Part of our complicated immigration system, that's Brian Bennett. He's a staff writer for the LA Times, joining us from their D.C. bureau. He covers immigration and homeland security. Our second of three guests in this hour of Radio Times, we're taking a look at our immigration system and the fact that the president is threatening to use his executive authority to make some changes in our immigration system. Brian just outlined some of the potential changes. And we want to hear from you at 1-888- 877-944-9999. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Are you looking for reforms or changes to our immigration system? Brian, it seems at least vocally that Republicans are pushing back on this. And obviously we're talking about come 2015, even more Republicans in the U.S. Congress. How do you see this playing out?
It's going to be very contentious, especially for these next 2 months. The Republicans just won a massive victory, and they feel like Obama should be chastened by the Democrats' loss, and should be, and then they feel like they have a mandate to move forward on their priorities, and that by Obama moving forward with, as he said he would, with this these executive actions on immigration, that Obama's flouting the results of the elections, and I think we will see. The Republicans are drawn out on this, and the question is how far they're willing to go. Some of the Republicans are pushing their leadership to shut the government down, or at least threaten to not pass some mandatory spending bills that will be on the table in the next few weeks. If Obama moves forward with the executive actions on immigration, and that's a risky move for the Republicans. It hasn't worked out well for them in the past. It's soured public relations for them, but they feel like they now have control of Congress, and with that comes the control, the power of the purse, and they feel like Obama should not be making such broad and sweeping changes to the immigration system without going through Congress.
Well, he did say, and it is an interesting kind of showdown that he set up. He did say to Congress, if you can come up with a bill that I can sign, I will sign it. But the Senate passed a bill on immigration that hasn't made it through the House. One wonders, with even more Republicans in Congress, whether there would be any movement on any bill when it comes to immigration.
It's a possibility, but I'd say it's a remote possibility that the Republican-held Congress would pick up an immigration bill. As Obama is trying to put the ball in their court by saying, look, you can reverse my executive actions by passing a law that, that is similar to the Senate immigration bill that passed, that tries to fix some of the problems that are broken with the system. And it doesn't look like that's going to be a priority for the Republicans going forward in the next few months.
But, and this is a very political question, but obviously we have learned that Latinos are now the majority minority. Do you think there are risks for the Republicans if they don't move on this, and perhaps it's a benefit for the president or Democrats if there is some movement on this, even if the president takes executive action?
So this has been a debate within the Republican Party for a number of years, going back to George W. Bush's administration. There are people within the Republican Party who feel like, with the growing Latino electorate, that they need to make sure that they keep Latinos in the fold in the party and draw them in. And George W. Bush also tried to get a comprehensive immigration reform package passed through Congress when he was president, and that was unsuccessful. And he believed that it was important for the future of the party to do that, and that it would be hard for future Republicans to be elected president if they didn't have a decent portion of the Latino electorate. I think right now that debate is still going on inside the Republican Party. I think the voices inside the party who feel like they should keep a hard line on border security are winning out, and now they're going to face a presidential election in 2 years, and we'll have to see how the primary looks for them and what candidate they decide to put forward, whether it's a candidate who is in favor of comprehensive reform or a candidate who thinks that absolutely the border needs to be secured first before any other concessions are made.
And I do want to get to our callers, but it is interesting to be having this conversation now when President Ronald Reagan was able to get pretty comprehensive immigration reform passed back in the 1980s. The first President Bush able to do the same. As you said, George W. Bush unable to, Obama unable to. Is it just that toxic an issue today?
Well, I think people who watch the Senate bill go through and get passed on a bipartisan basis do believe that if the vote, if the bill had come up for a vote in the House, that it would have had enough votes. But it's such a hot button issue within the Republican caucus in the House that Speaker Boehner didn't want to, didn't feel like he had enough of the support of his own caucus in the House to move forward on it. And I think that illustrates how politically dangerous the topic can be for Republicans, and how they feel like they they're on the right path right now, and they're probably going to continue taking a harder line on immigration.
Let me see what Jose from Burlington County has to say. Jose, go ahead. You are on Radio Times. Or not. I will. Well, let me read what Jose says here. He says the delayed action of immigration reform has perpetuated more and more problems, and the idea of Congress not being able to respond to representatives is a form of, or is an example of dysfunction and malfeasance. I mean, I think you can pick a number of different issues, Brian Bennett, and show use that as an example of the kind of frustration that the public has with our Congress. And I even am curious about. If you've looked at polls to decide whether there is, or if we know how much support there is for the kind of immigration reform we've been talking about.
Yeah, so last year when the Senate was considering this bill, there was a pretty good public support for it. That support has gone down over the last year. And one thing that's interesting about a compromise like the Senate bill put together is that it has a bit for different sides. So it does create a legalization program, because if senators felt like you needed to create a solution for the 11 million people who are already here, some of whom have deep roots in the community here. So it does create a legalization, but it also does things like creates an employer mandate that requires employers to check people they're hiring on a federal database for their immigration status, which they don't currently have to do. It also, more than doubled the presence on the border for security, put a lot more money into border security, and for the business community, which feel like the process for getting visas for foreign workers is really onerous and takes a long time, it streamlined that and opened up more visas for skilled foreign workers. So whenever a compromise solution like that is brought up, there are parts of the immigration system that aren't working from the perspective of people across the ideological divide, and there are a lot of different solutions that are put forward all together in one package.
I mean, we know that there are critics of what the president or even what the Democrats are offering. What do Republicans and critics of those plans and ideas, what are they offering instead?
Well, so the Republican Party chairman, Reince Priebus, he said that he thought that the border had to be secured first. So the House Republicans, if they're an indication of how the Republicans might, what their posture might be on immigration for the next 2 years in Congress, they said that, look, we need to take a step-by-step approach to solving the immigration problems. And that means passing bills that boost border security first, and then addressing opening up and streamlining the visa programs. And probably the last step they would envision would be to create a process by which people here illegally can get right with the law. So the Republicans so far have said, look, we need to first invest in border security. Now, I think the pushback on that has been, how do you know when you've done enough? Because it's such a difficult problem, and it's so hard to measure. And the more barriers you put up, the more ingenious ways people come up with to get around them. And so people feel like putting border security first is great in principle, but it can often just delay the solutions that are needed off into the indefinite future. And in the meantime, businesses are having a harder time getting people in, and families who have family members waiting outside of the country, are living apart.
And how much do you think the child migration crisis of last summer along the Texas-Mexico border, how much do you think that has exacerbated whatever deal could be worked out between these competing parties?
Yeah, I really think that crisis threw a spanner in the works and really made it much more difficult for President Obama to go forward with some of these administrative actions earlier because of the political liabilities. And I think there were concerns among Democrats that if they did those actions before the election, that it would draw out Republican voters even more than it did.
And we're almost out of time here. And do you think Obama's looking at his legacy? He's got two more years in office.
I do. I think that Obama's been so heavily criticized on the left for the high number of deportations during his tenure that I think he's looking at how he wants to be remembered among the Latino community. And I think right now the polling shows that he doesn't have as high favorable views from Latino voters as he did when he came in, because he came in on an election promise to try to fix the immigration system. So I think he's looking at his legacy, how he wants to be remembered by Latino voters, and I think he believes that taking administrative actions on his own is the best step he can do toward preserving that legacy. And I think he generally hopes that it will goad the Republicans in Congress into taking some action that makes permanent these changes.
Well, Brian Bennett, we have to say goodbye. Thanks for joining us today on Radio Times. He's a staff writer for the LA Times, a third guest waiting in the wings. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Last Friday, the U.S. House of Representatives voted 252 to 161 to approve construction of the Keystone XL pipeline. Republican Bill Cassidy authored the bill and is in a runoff election with Louisiana Senator Mary Landrieu, who is co-sponsor of a similar bill in the Senate that's expected to be voted on tomorrow. Joining us to discuss pipeline politics and the status of the controversial project is Joe Wirtz, multi-platform reporter for State Impact Oklahoma. And Joe Wirtz, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thanks for having me today.
You're very welcome. And do you think these midterm elections are going to change the status or even the future of the Keystone XL pipeline?
Well, it certainly seems like it. At least, the pipeline has really become a political a lot more meaningful in a political sense, at least lately, than it's been in a energy market sense. But certainly, it seems like lawmakers are poised to make some movement on it. I think whether or not President Obama will end up ultimately rejecting the proposal and vetoing it, I think remains to be seen. But it certainly seems like there's political momentum at this point to do something.
You're joining us from Oklahoma. And, we're here on the East Coast and probably don't know about, for instance, Cushing, Oklahoma, which really is this kind of bottleneck or sort of central headquarters for a lot of the piping, even beyond Keystone XL pipeline, a lot of the pipes that run through the middle of the country. Can you describe that for our listeners?
Sure. So Cushing, Oklahoma, it's sort of in the north central part of Oklahoma, and it bills itself as the pipeline crossroads of the world. And if you can imagine, just it's the middle of the prairie, and there's just hundreds of these looming giant oil storage tanks, pipeline hubs, terminals. It's it looks like a moon base or something. This was one of the original oil plays in Oklahoma that was quickly drained and left out. So when the oil boom left this area, what remained there was a lot of pipeline infrastructure and storage tanks. So they just built this thing up, and it's a hub. It's a terminal. It's sort of the halfway point between producers and refineries, and most of the refineries down in the Gulf Coast of Texas. So oil travels through Oklahoma, connects at the Cushing oil hub on its way to refineries. And the price of oil, West Texas Intermediate, is priced at Cushing. So it's important for the transport of oil, also important for energy markets, because that's where the price is determined.
And Joe, what we're really talking about when there is controversy and even votes on this Keystone XL pipeline, it's from Canada to what? To a part of the Midwest, not Canada to the Gulf Coast, because that already exists.
Right. So when we talk about Keystone, it's important to remember that this is a pipeline network, and it's a bunch of different pipeline sections. Some are already built. We've already got a pipeline from the tar sands to Nebraska and into Kansas. What all this controversy about is about a separate section of this pipeline that would connect through Nebraska, and it got held up because of environmental concerns in Nebraska. But that would be built to carry additional capacity. So right now there is a network. Oklahoma is connected to Kansas and to Nebraska. Part of it connects over into Illinois. So we're really talking about one section of a pipeline network, and I think that's important to remember.
Indeed. And why do you think this one section has gotten so much attention and even become such a focus of controversy and debate?
There are, you know, legitimate concerns, I think, with the route. I think Nebraska's got a sensitive environmental area. There's certainly sensitive environmental areas in every state along the path of these pipelines. But in Nebraska, the Sand Hills area was particularly sensitive. The governor there, some of the lawmakers there, were particularly worried about it hitting the Sand Hills area, really kind of put up some objections when this permit process was going through. And so I think there are concerns. They're all, you know, stepping a little bit outside of the U.S. equation here and getting more on a global concern. I think some environmentalists don't want to see the oil sands, the tar sands in Canada produced more. They think it's a particularly dirty type of oil. They see any effort to continue producing, increase production out of those tar sands as increasing, you know, toxic greenhouse gas emissions, increasing reliance on fossil fuels. So they see, you know, any chance to keep producing and increase production out of the tar sands as a bad thing. So, you know, the U.S. fits into that equation. State Department reports said, look, you know, if the price is right, they're going to get that oil out of Canada one way or another, and whether or not this pipeline goes online is not probably going to have any effect on that. But I do think there are environmental concerns both in Canada, people along the route. Also in Texas, you know, there were some eminent domain issues, people not wanting the pipeline running through their land. So lots of concerns along the way, but it hit a good time in presidential politics also for it to just become a political football. And I don't think that can be ignored.
Well, neither do I. That's Joe Wirtz. He's a multi-platform reporter for State Impact Oklahoma, and we are talking about the Keystone XL pipeline. The U.S. House of Representatives voted on Friday to approve its construction. If you've been following this, you know that there have been a number of votes on the Keystone XL pipeline. President Obama says essentially it's a State Department decision because it's oil, tar sands oil coming from Canada to the United States, a very complicated issue. And that's why we asked Joe Wirtz to join us in this third segment of Radio Times in this first hour of the show. You can join us as well. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Joe, I do want to get to some of the email comments that we have here, but just a quick question for you. So if there is no pipeline, would this oil be then trucked or used trains to transport the oil down to either Cushing or down to some of these other headquarters?
You bet. I mean, oil is a global market. It's an international market. Until recently, the price of oil has been very high. They were, you know, oil producers, energy companies are in the business of selling oil and in business of producing oil, and they will get it out and get it to market any way possible if the price is right. And I think you do see you know, pipelines are considered the safest way to transport crude oil long distances, but they will use any means necessary, and they've carried it by train, by, you know, by barge in some cases, by truck in some cases. You do see, you know, an increase in accidents with trains carrying a lot of this crude. It's not as safe as carrying it over a pipeline. So when the price of oil is right and these people are pumping it out of the ground, you can bet that they're going to find a way to get it to market, whether it's on a pipeline or on a truck or on a train.
We have an email from Gary. He says, are there any discussions regarding safety and security as far as tampering or even, as he says here, terrorist attacks? But what about, I mean, these are pipelines that are sitting out in the open. What's the protection for them, Joe?
Well, these are pipelines that are sitting out in the open, sort of. They are buried underground. That's important to know, except for certain areas where they might cross over, you know, a waterway or in certain areas. Most of these pipelines are buried. As somebody that's gone out lots of times to see the pipeline, to interview people working on it, it can be kind of hard to tell where this thing is unless they're working on it. So, you know, I've also, tried to get records on where exactly this map would be, computer mapping records, and they've been very protective over that. So there is, some concern about that. It's also important to note that there's a bazillion pipelines all over the place, and, you know, the same protections go into to keeping an eye on those. But we're talking about thousands of miles of pipeline. It's impossible to guard the whole thing the whole way. But it is buried underground. It is hard to see. And they do restrict some information on the exact locations of a lot of it.
I've heard a number of different numbers about the numbers of jobs that would be created with the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline. I think TransCanada is talking about 100,000 direct and indirect jobs. What are your findings on that, Joe?
Well, and they're all over the map. Certainly, the company TransCanada that's would like to, it's their pipeline that's in there to use the rosiest possible job prediction numbers, and I think. On the other end, some of the more devout environmentalists might take the opposite approach and try to undersell the amount of jobs. I think it's fair to say the number of permanent, you know, full-time jobs is fairly low. I've seen some estimates, putting the number around 50. But in Oklahoma, when they were building the southern portion of this pipeline, the portion that would go from Cushing, Oklahoma, to the refineries in Texas, I mean, there were 600 to 800 workers, in Oklahoma welding this thing together, putting it together, digging the trenches. And those jobs are temporary, but when you interview those men and women, they tell you, look, all jobs are temporary. This is our livelihood. This is how we work. We go move from one job to another, and this is a great job. So I think it does produce jobs. A lot of the jobs are construction jobs, temporary jobs, but those are valuable, and to talk to those people, it's not a full-time job, and they're going to be set for life, but if they get 9 months' worth of welding work out of it, that's, that's their full-time job for that year, and I don't think you can ignore that either.
We have an email from Bernie from East Kensington saying, isn't this oil coming from another country and isn't it being exported? I don't see how this helps America's energy independence. And as I said, this is a very complicated issue. Can you respond to that, Joe?
Sure. A lot of this, if this went online, would be oil from Canada, another country. There are ways to bring American oil in on this pipeline. A lot of that's what happens at Cushing. We bring American oil into the system there. So there are domestic producers here in the U.S. that would be able to feed oil into this pipeline. It would be open to do that. So we're talking about some of the oil production in North Dakota, Montana, kind of burgeoning plays in Wyoming potentially could feed into this. But yes, largely this is a international oil thing that would bring oil from Canada. And I think the worry you get from some people is when we have this Keystone pipeline conversation at the same time as we have a simultaneous oil export conversation, people worry that the U.S. is going to be basically just a pass-through for oil to go from Canada all the way through the U.S. due to the Gulf Coast, where it'll get refined or just shipped out of the terminal there on its way to another country. So I think there is concern about that, but we do have producers in the U.S. that will be able to use the capacity on the pipeline.
Let me get to Margaret from Newark, Delaware, to join us. Hi, Margaret. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I just wanted to say that we have a very...
Oh, we just lost Margaret there. We still have you, hopefully, Joe. We just lost Margaret. There is concern. I can see them from the emails and also the phone calls here. Concern about just this issue of safety and oil spills of the past.
Right.
And I mean, this we're talking about. What powers our country, but nonetheless, there are the possibility of spills and accidents.
Absolutely, and I think it's important to note that there is no perfect way to transport, crude oil. It's a dangerous substance. It's a toxic substance. It can create absolute environmental havoc. There's no doubt about it. It's a gradient. It's all, different levels of safety. Pipelines are considered among the safest, but that doesn't mean they're not without,
right.
there have been massive accidents that have happened from this. Objectively, they're generally not, they don't happen all the time. I think that's pretty clear, but they do happen, and when they do happen, it's really bad. There's also concern about the particular type of oil that comes from this spot in Canada, this from the tar sands, bitumen. Some suggestions that this oil is particularly corrosive. It's particularly hard to clean up. It sinks. So when it does leak and when there are spills with this oil, that it's particularly hard to clean up. But still, again, if the price of oil is right, these companies are going to be producing it. In general, bird's eye view is that you would rather it be transported on a pipeline than on a truck or train. But if that pipeline's in your backyard and it's leaking or leaking into your river or creek, there's no doubt that it's a disaster.
About a minute before we have to say goodbye here, but let's say Congress passes it and let's say the president signs it. I'm not saying he will or he won't. Are there still local issues that might hold up the pipeline? About 45 seconds, Joe, before we have to say goodbye.
Well, all politics is local. I think any type of small local issue, as we saw in Nebraska with the Sand Hills, could get elevated and become a talking point in order to deny the permit. I think it's still unclear what Obama is going to do. He's been, this thing's been bouncing around a while, and he's been pretty clear so far that, in denying the permit. So it'll be interesting to see. But no objections, no local issues here in Oklahoma. We're already transporting on a section of the Keystone to the Gulf. Oklahoma's interested in getting the glut of oil out of Cushing. So no local objections here, but I wouldn't be surprised if some little issue gets becomes a big issue on a national stage again.
Well, Joe Wirtz, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And he's platform reporter for State Impact Oklahoma. You probably know State Impact Pennsylvania. That's where we cover some of these local energy issues. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of the show. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.